Welcome to the Nest of Vipers podcast, cultural chit-chat by and for know-it-alls, ne'er-do-wells, and nattering nabobs everywhere. I'm your host, Danny Plotnick. And each week on the show, we have an esteemed panel of blabbermouths telling stories and riffing on some scintillating topics. And today, we're going to talk about our most humiliating moments as artists. And let me get right to it, introducing the panelists right here to my left. Not that that means anything to you listening to a podcast. Is writer, poet, comedian, gadfly, Bucky Sinister, author of the minor hit book, Whiskey and Robots. And over here we have musician, filmmaker, bon vivant, Kurt Kepler, currently in the band Fierce Antler. Kurt, say hello.
Hello, everybody, and I'm pleased to be here.
All right. And rounding out our merry band of fundits, as we've come to call them, is musician and Nest of Vipers house engineer Chris Zifos, moving from the back line to the front line today. And Chris has been in The Moth Wranglers, King Missile, Drop Quarters, and has produced many fine records.
And about let's not forget When People Were Shorter and Lived Near the Water.
Oh, we can't forget that. All right. And just to sort of set the stage for the conversation today is I think one thing that holds true for all artists, no matter how successful, is that at some point you just experience a horrifically embarrassing moment in public, be it some show or appearance that goes horribly wrong. And of course, the great thing about that, it usually happens in front of hundreds of people, if you're lucky, because you're always hoping hundreds of people are going to be there. But then that moment when things go horribly wrong, you kind of wish that maybe nobody had shown up.
Right.
And speaking of nobody showing up, we will start with Mr. Sinister right here.
Thank you. Well, mine is takes place in Albuquerque, New Mexico, during the Albuquerque Poetry Festival, which kind of before the Poetry Slam scene really took off, it was really the biggest gathering every year of bar poets and underground poets from across the country. This? It was about 98, I think. Yeah, and it was like this big thing. It was like kind of like Sturgis for poets, right? Like all the...
Sturgis?
What's Sturgis?
Sturgis is the big biker rally every year is in Sturgis.
South Dakota.
It's kind of like that. It's like all the poets that kind of descend upon Albuquerque.
And we just scooters?
Anyway we get there. And it would just like, you know, it would just kind of raise hell for a week. And it was a lot of fun. And I knew a lot of people, a lot of these people who had come through the Chameleon over the years and where I was hosting readings. Would all see me there. And
that's a low life bar in San Francisco, yeah, for those of you unfamiliar with that reference.
Since I didn't get to tour much, you know, that was the one time they'd see me somewhere else. So everybody would, you know, just really treat me to parties and drinks and whatnot. You know, everybody's coming to see me and it's like, hey, let's, you know, do a shot. Let me get you a drink. And so about 8 o'clock or something, when everyone's just having their first drink, I'm already kind of plastered.
Is it 8 a.m. or p.m.?
I kind of stayed drunk there for about a week. Like every week I just kind of like stay high or drunk or something the whole time. This particular night, it was one of those things where I was the really drunk guy first. Like there was only one really drunk guy in the bar and it was me. And they were trying to have like the opening night festivities with, I'm not sure who else was there, but I do remember Adam Parfrey was there. He's a publisher of Feral House. And he was reading out of Apocalypse
Culture.
Wait, that's
your publisher, isn't it?
No, and it probably never will be. Let's hear the rest of the story. I'm not even really sure if he remembers it was me, but
I'll be sure to email him.
He was reading out of Apocalypse Culture, and I really think to this day I really ascertained that he was bombing. That he was just that people were like kind of getting up and walking away, and he was reading from like the kind of the boring parts of the book. I mean, he really took it as great, exciting book. And really was reading, like, just killing it.
He was dying.
Yeah. He's not, like, a performer. He's a publisher. So that's fine. But I was, like, yelling out parts of the book to read from. And Parfrey at one point makes a fatal mistake of saying, hey, if you got something to say, why don't you come up here and say it?
Which is,
like, kind of, like, bluffing. It's called bluffing the heckler. And, like, you don't really want to do it because there's too many times when, like, someone will take the microphone away from you. And especially if it's, like, some kind of a-hole like me – Like, you won't get it back. And that's precisely what happened. I was like, okay, you know, fine, I'll come like up you. There. Like, mm. And it was one of those things, too, that, like, I've been drinking at this table for a while. Like, all these multiple shots of people that were just keep bringing me.
Had you stood up in a while?
No, no. See, that's the thing. And so I stand up, and I'm like, oh, crap. And I go to settle. I kind of go to settle my hand on a table. Oh. It's one of those kind of tall tables. And it spills. It knocks over the whole table and spills all the drinks on me. I'm wearing this light gray shirt, and it's just covered.
It's sort of like to be like drinking a Long Island iced tea.
It's got like a t-shirt. Not only that, it's a t-shirt of Bucky the Badger, the Wisconsin mascot. And it says F'em Bucky. So it's like, not only does it have an expletive of my name on it, it's also covered in you know, Cosmos or whatever. And I went up there and I got on the microphone and no one else like cut me off. And I just kept going. Not only did I take up all of Parfrey's time, I took up all the next guy's time too. And I was riffing, and I think a lot of people were just
Well, the great thing is that if this had happened in Sturgis, someone would have probably just come up there and kind of hit you with a tire iron.
Well, if it had happened on Valencia Street at the time, that would have happened too. I mean, we're kind of playing mission rules, and just like, look, if you want me off, like, you know, you better take me off.
Right.
And that was kind of like how things worked on Guerrero Street and now Beyond Street and you know, like at the poetry readings of the mission. And like, no one there really knew what to do. It wasn't so embarrassing at the time because I was hammered and I thought I was great. But what's embarrassing is that someone was videotaping the whole thing.
Everything looks a little better with the bear goggles
someone
on.
Someone was videotaping the whole thing, and that tape passed around like it was like, you know, Shatner singing Rocket Man.
Or the two bar.
Yeah, it like went around the country. This tape went around the country before finally someone lost it. You know, if this had happened today, it would have been YouTubed like right away, and I never would have gotten rid of this thing. It was years people were going like, hey, I saw a video of you. Like, I would meet somebody, and it would be like, not like, hey, I read your book, it was great. It was like, hey, I saw a video of you yelling at Parfrey. And I was like,
it's like being on America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yeah, getting hit in the nuts. Yeah, like, really, I got hit in the nuts. It's like, you know what?
By
a
cat. Someone threw the cat at your nuts.
Yeah, totally. It's like, you know, yeah, you know, I won the Nobel Peace Prize for curing, I cured AIDS and cancer with the same thing, you know, using only peanut butter and duct tape. And but what I'm going to be remembered for is, yeah, the cat jumping on my face and getting hit with a wiffle ball bat in the nuts.
And, you know. But well, were you any good on stage?
I wasn't. I wasn't that night, and that's the whole shame of it. If I could have really gone up there and really sold it, and you know, turned it around, it wouldn't be embarrassing. It would be like, see, I'm a genius. But that's why it's embarrassing. It was because not only was it a horrible performance, but it was caught on video. And there are many more horrible performances. Sure, I just don't have to cop to them really because there's no proof. That's definitely it. There are many small ones. There are many small ones like somebody had my book one time and said, oh, you know, brought it to a reading and said, I really like your book. I said, you want me to sign it for you? He's like, no, you already signed it for my sister, and you also put your phone number in there. You were trying to pick her up in the uptown, like by giving her a book. I was like, yeah, I might have done that. Yeah, it's just the embarrassment shared by me and like one or two other people. But that one's like the Albuquerque night was shared by hundreds, if not thousands, through the magic of home video.
But there was only one tape,
As far as I know. And it's gone. I mean
people weren't that stupid in 1998. You wouldn't just send the tape. You'd make a dub. There are more out there, is what I'm saying.
I think this is going to resurface.
It could very well resurface. I mean, I always think about it. I mean, it's one of those things. Like, you know,
maybe one of the listeners to this podcast may have it.
Totally. You know, and yeah, don't, like, I'll forget about it. In 20 years from now, I'll show up on YouTube. You know, it will. Like, it'll, you know, show up in, you know, the YouTube
maybe more like
version.
20 minutes from now.
Yeah, totally. It's already been taken down. You know, it's just, I don't really think that, like, people did copy it, really, like, because it was the poets. They could barely, like, you know, photocopy a chapbook back then. So it's just like, you know, if they put staples on only one side of the book, they were doing well. Right. So they would staple every side of the book shut. And that's kind of more who we were dealing with. You know, the guy who used to shoot in the Chameleon all the time, who brought his video camera for many, many weeks, shot all the footage in there. He disappeared one day, and we found me and Tommy Stolmar were in the uptown one night, and we're yapping away, and this guy says, oh, you guys are poets, and we're like, oh, yeah, we're like ready to fight or whatever. And I, you know, what is it? Where is it? We didn't know where it was going. Like, people say that, like, you still don't know really how to take it. And he goes, oh, maybe you knew my dad. And we're like, who's your dad? And he's like, oh, my dad's this guy. And we're like, oh, man, do you know how to get in touch with him? And he's like, well, you know what? He shot himself on Christmas a couple years ago. And we're like, oh, that's why we hadn't seen him, you know? After we talked to him for a while, I said, you know, maybe it doesn't look like anything to you, but it would mean a lot to me. He has all these videotapes, and it just looks like a bunch of idiots rambling on, but it would really be great if I could get those, and I'll copy them and get them back to you or whatever, or I'll pay like a service to have them all compiled into one thing. And he just got this weird look on his face, and I kept trying to sell it, like maybe he doesn't want to give them to me or whatever.
He was holding out for some money.
Yeah, I didn't know what he was thinking. And then he says, my dad never had tape in his camera. And I was like, what? And he's like, oh, that was just his way of fitting into the world. Like, he felt really uncomfortable, like, out in public. So if he had a camera that had a little red light on, no one would talk to him. You know, that's how he viewed the whole world, through that camera, but he never recorded anything.
You needed him in Albuquerque.
Wow. Yeah, videotaping. Yeah, totally. That's the kind of people we're dealing with. So that whole idea that they even taped it, that they're able to make the tape happen, is enough on its own.
All right. Chris Zifos, can you top that?
Well, actually, there are two different stories that I was thinking of. There's one story that was somewhat humiliating to me, but then there's another story that was more humiliating to my bandmate at the time. So I don't know. Which story do you think I should go with?
Well, which bandmate?
Well, you know, it's...
As tempted as I am, I'm going to go with let's embarrass you.
Oh, okay.
It is about you.
And if he dies, then he dies on that one. He can switch to the other story.
You're right. If it's bombing.
Right, if it's bombing.
If Bucky runs over there, punches you out, and grabs the microphone, we'll go to the other one.
Okay, that's fine. So King Missile, the band I was playing in at the time, this was 1993, was playing a gig in Seattle. And just to kind of run up to the gig in Seattle, a few days before, we played in Bozeman, Montana. And then from Bozeman, we drove directly to Seattle. And I drove.
How far of a drive is that?
It's like 10 hours.
Yeah, it's 10 hours. Exactly. Yeah. So I drove that whole thing, and then I went out that night. I was like, I'm in Seattle. I have got to go out. You know, so I was like up late. And then the next day, we played in Vancouver. So we had to get up early to do a border crossing, that whole thing. And then from Vancouver, we drove back to Seattle after the gig because we had a hotel room in Seattle. So then by the time
you know, the Canadian dollar goes pretty far. You could probably find a pretty nice place in Vancouver for half the cost.
I know. But we had decided to camp out in Seattle and have our sort of base in Seattle for that period of time. So again, it was another really late night. So here we are, like, you know, 3 days later, and I haven't had much sleep. We were playing at this big, huge place, and the band that was opening for us was a very popular band in Seattle. So all of their fans...
Nirvana.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't Nirvana, but...
Was it Cat Butt?
Yeah, right.
Soundgarden.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were really popular in Seattle.
Cat.
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, it wasn't Cat. It wasn't Cat.
Screaming Trees.
No. It was this band called Hammerbox. And
it would have taken us a while to get
there.
There
was a lot of Hammer bands.
Right. Exactly. MC Hammer.
Yeah. And like Claw Hammer.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So they were one of the Hammer bands.
Hammerhead.
You know, and then they were one of the box bands too, because there was Candlebox and Hammerbox. Yeah. You know, so Hammer, Garden. so Hammerbox had all their fans there, and it was an all ages show. So it was an all ages show. So there was tons of kids.
So there were a lot of underage drunks there.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they have a radio hit?
Hammerbox? No, Hammerbox never had a radio hit. But again, they were, you know, I mean, the Seattle scene is this kind of weird sort of insular scene where people in Seattle just love music. And that's why, you know, when it ended up going national, you know, it just sort of made sense because people always just go to see bands there. There's this culture of going out to see music. And a lot of underage shows, the all-ages shows too.
Underage shows.
Yeah. Sorry.
Your specialty.
Yeah.
You had to be under 18 to get in here. You must be under, like, right. One of those things with a hand. Like, you must be under. They're just tall to get into this show.
Right, exactly. So anyway, so with all this all-ages crowd, you know, there's a lot of excited, you know, teenagers. And, you know, here I am, you know, the grumpy guy who hasn't slept in 3 days, you know. At the time, we were kind of touring on our big hit, So, you know, there was a lot of people out to see us.
Detachable penis.
Yes, thank you very much. So there,
it was, and we were so trying to keep the language clean.
Hey, you could say that word on the radio. Okay, you're good. It's fine. That's why it was such a big hit.
You're right. All right.
You know, because you could say that word.
Would that be penis?
Yes.
Okay.
So the weird thing about this place was that I remember the stage not being that big. The weird thing about the stage was that the across the back of the stage was corrugated tin.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's just sort of like, you know, sort of like a aesthetic
industrial
thing.
Yeah.
It was the sound bouncing off of that corrugated tin was unreal.
Yeah, and the tin itself will just vibrate.
You know, I was having a really hard time. Plus, after not sleeping for 3 days, it was just making me insane. About 3 or 4 songs into the set, you know, the kids are, of course, like slamming around, like, you know, having a great time, you know, they're all excited.
I love that there'd be a pit for King Missile.
Oh, yeah, there was pits.
Steal stuff from work.
Yeah, there were
93, there was a pit for anything.
Yeah, like, you know, absolutely.
Like, this is what you turn the PA on, the pit.
Yeah.
You know? The hum.
Yeah, totally. There were pits at Jesus Jones concert.
Well, I mean, in fact, that was at our first show in Seattle in 91, there was like a pit. I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? So there was, you know, there was that happening and whatever. Like, and it was probably like maybe even the third song in, something like that. Some kid jumped up onto the stage and took my set list, right? Mm-hmm. And
I'm not going to wait for the show to end.
Right, exactly.
When everyone's going to be trying to take the set list, I'm getting it now.
Right? So the kid jumps up, takes the set list, right? Now, at this point, we had been on this tour. And, I mean, it was... you know,
so
it was
you should have known that set list.
This was actually this was April. In fact, I remember the day. It was the day they raided the Koresh. That whole the Branch Davidians.
Branch Davidians.
Yeah, it was that day. So that would have been like April in '93, and we had been on tour since February of '93. So we were like, you know,
that's 2 months.
Yeah, and okay. You know, in that time period too, I broke up with my boyfriend. I had all this stuff like happening. It was just like, but you know, we were having this big hit with the song that I hated, and this like, you know, this whole thing. It was just like, you know, just making me crazy.
That's when you can go postal.
Right, exactly. But we had been on tour since February, and we were basically playing the same set. So I really didn't need the set list. The fact that this kid like jumped up and took the set list, right? And my whole thing of everything kind of like crashing down at that point, at the end of that song that we were doing, I just like went into my microphone. I said, give me back that set list. I need it. Like right at that kid. And the whole place stopped and looked. Everybody on stage looked at me. Everybody out in the audience looked at me. And this little kid was like, kind of crept back to the stage and like put the set list back in front of me. Then I realized what an idiot I was, and then half the audience left.
Oh, nice.
I mean, not right after that, but really from that point on, people started leaving and leaving and leaving until finally by the end of the set, there was definitely half the people there that were there when we started. And, you know, I kind of sort of attributed it to my little like
tantrum.
Meltdown. Yeah, your hissy fit.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt really horrible.
Did the rest of the band think so? Were they riding you for us?
No, they really didn't, because I did stupid stuff all the time. You know, I mean,
yeah, pull it back, Grumpy.
You know, exactly.
Did anyone come to your defense on stage?
No. Definitely not. But I knew that they were all looking at me like, what the hell are you doing?
And it was one of them underage kids too, right?
Yeah, exactly. He must have been like 16 or 17. I mean, not even. He was like a small kid, whatever. Yeah. You know,
there's a tear in his eye. I used to love this band.
I know, exactly. I mean, I thought I broke this kid's heart. Yeah. And then like, you know, like what? What did I just
do?
But
you felt really lousy when he died of leukemia about a year later.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I wanted a set list from that show.
Yeah, yeah. The Make-A-Wish people were like, dear King Missile, thanks a lot, jerks. His one wish is to come see the Detachable Penis live.
And then, of course, you know, the next time we play in Seattle, we play at the 21 and Over place, and then like, and it's not well attended. So,
and this guy comes back, he's huge, and he's like, remember me? I was that kid you told on stage.
You hurt my feelings.
He's, you know, looks like a guy in Cape Fear. He's just been like, you know.
Also, that's the Incredibles too. That's the storyline in the Incredibles too.
So. He's been lifting weights, like listening to detachable penis, right. Over Holy and over. I'll show them. I'm going to turn John Hall into a little girl.
God. All right. Well, very good. Well, I'll dig into mine. And then we'll go to Kurt. So my story also takes place in Canada. We went to Canada there for a minute.
At some point.
And back in the mid-90s, so... this is the late 90s. I'm going with this is maybe 1999. Well, no, back in the mid-90s, I mean, I'm a filmmaker, and one of my things was I made Super 8 films. I was the Super 8 guy. That was sort of my, that was my expertise. And in the late 90s, a festival in Toronto kicked up called the Splice This Film Festival. There was a Super 8 fest. And in their first year of existence, they asked me to write the program notes for their catalog, and they got a lot of recommendations for films to show from me. And, it looked like a good festival. And in their second year, they invited me out to be the special guest. You know, so they were going to fly me to Toronto to be the special guest of the festival, which essentially entailed being on a panel. I was going to show one really old film and be on a panel. And I just got to that point in my life where I was maybe making enough money and I was getting old enough that I said, I'm never flying a red eye again. I'm willing to pay the extra $25 to not get on a flight at 10 p.m. and arrive somewhere at 5 in the morning. And so when they booked my ticket, they booked me on the red eye. And I'm like... You know, I hate to be a prima donna, but can I not go on the red eye? And they were like, well, you know, we just don't have a lot of money and we're like spending a third of our budget on flying you out from San Francisco. You know, can you please come on the red eye? And of course, I relented. And whatever. So I go out there, first couple days of the festival are really great. And, one night after the show, standing outside at 2 in the morning, and someone comes up to me and says, are you going to go to the breakfast tomorrow? And I'm like, I don't know, what breakfast? And she's like, oh, some people are just going out for breakfast, 10 o'clock, you know. I'm like, well, you know, I'll see what I'm doing. And of course,
out for breakfast at 5 a.m. because it's $2 cheaper. Yeah. The early bird special. Got to get up before dawn.
But,
the budget.
I wake up and of course I'm going to go to breakfast. And one of these things, you know, I'm playing hard to get at 2 in the morning. Yeah. I don't know. So I go to the breakfast and I get there and it's the morning of the panel. And what immediately strikes me as weird is everyone involved in the panel is there. It seems like it's this very formal breakfast for people on the panel, yet no one really invited me. I mean, the person who said, are you going, was only tangentially related. I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. Everyone else is here, the panelists, the moderator, the festival directors. I'm like, all right, I can get over that. I can eat my pancakes and not really worry about it too much. And then the moderator of the panel comes up to me and she's like, you know, I really hate to say this, but I'm not really familiar with your work at all. Would it be okay if we sat together during breakfast so I can talk to you? And then right there, I'm like, well, wait a second. These people spent a third of their budget, made me take the red eye to ostensibly be on this panel. And the moderator doesn't know my work. And I'm like, that's kind of lame. And I'm like, well, at least she had the guts to come up to me beforehand
middle of the panel.
And so that's cool. We had a great talk, at breakfast. And so that's cool. So we go over to the panel.
She'd given her like a bunch of Richard Kern films and said, watch these. these are mine.
So we go to the panel. And the panel, it was four filmmakers and a journalist. And me and the journalist are going to have problems at some point.
The scourge of every filmmaker's soul.
And the panel was at noon and it was in a bar, but the bar was closed. I mean, it was just being housed in a bar. And eventually the bar being closed is going to become a problem for me as well. And the panel is like a 90-minute panel, which is actually for five people on a panel. It's fairly short. Anyway, the panel starts. The moderator starts by introducing the one filmmaker on the panel who is a honest to goodness art star. And the moderator goes on, I mean, a 5-6 minute glowing introduction. I mean, just the most kiss-ass, glowing, flowering introduction. The kind of introduction you always hope you're going to get, you know, when you're on one of these things, but you never do.
Yeah.
And it was kind of making me sick at some point. It's like, just get on with it. It's obviously, you want to sleep with this person, let's just move on, you know, whatever it is. And then she has that filmmaker talk for 5 or 6 minutes or more. And then she's like, all right, well, let's take a look at one of your films. And she shows a movie for 5 or 6 minutes. And then they come back and talk about the movie for another 2 or 3 minutes. And if you've ever been on one of these panels, it's hard to sit there for like 20 or 25 minutes with your thumbs up your butt, not saying anything. And I'm kind of looking at my watch going, okay, there's 5 of us. And we're like into, you know, minute 20 and no one else has spoken at all. And then she introduces the journalist. And she talks about the journalist for 5 minutes. And then the journalist starts speaking. And at that point, I'm like, this is just getting ridiculous. And then the journalist says something that I absolutely disagree with beyond belief. And I mean, not to get into the Super 8 thing too much, but it was something along the lines of, because Super 8 was a home movie medium, all films made in Super 8 have to be viewed in the context of being home movies, which is just something that I thought was a ridiculous thing to say. And at that point, I just had enough. And I'm like, you know, I hate to butt in here, but that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I think I said, I couldn't disagree with you more. And I think that's just the kind of thinking that's killed Super 8. And just, you know, I figured, you know, let's just get controversial at this point. Because, the moderator isn't moderating a panel.
It does make for a good panel.
Like, yeah. You know. And I'm like, and at that point, I mean, similar to Chris's story, there was like this silence, the... You know, you can just hear the gas in the audience, and the moderator's like, oh, what do you mean? And then the thing that was crazy was everyone in the audience jumped to the journalist's defense. And they were like, he's right. And I'm sitting there going, there's one thing I know in this world. It's Super 8 films. And I kind of wanted to do that. All right, how many of you have made 15 Super 8 films in the last 10 years? Raise your hand. But it was this weird thing where everyone kind of started attacking me and defending the journalist. I mean, and that was all right. And there was some good discussion kind of going on, but the moderator just kind of stopped and she's like, well, let's go back to the journalist. Let's watch the movie he selected. And, you know, so did that. And then we do that. And she kind of comes back to me at that point. And then I realized she was kind of going alphabetically. And one of the things at breakfast, I asked her, like, am I going to have to prepare something to say, or are you just going to ask questions? She's like, oh, you don't have to prepare anything. So she starts introducing me, and she says something in the introduction that was completely wrong. She said that I'd gotten a master's in Super 8 film production at college. and it's the kind of thing that I could let go if I was on someone's podcast and someone said that. Yeah. I could let it go, but it's like, all right, it's a Super 8 fest. You can't insinuate that you can actually get a master's in making Super 8. Yeah. I'm like, well, you know, I don't mean to correct you, but... you know, that's wrong, you know? And then she's like, all right. And then her sort of question to me was like, so what's your deal? I mean, it was the most, you know, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay. So I guess I needed to think of something to say. And then of course I kind of stumbled through some intro and then, you know, I show my film. And again, I've made a lot of films that are kind of these bigger, more real productions. And I've made a lot of films that are these really small, off-the-cuff things. And the film that I was showing was this film called Isaki about a sock monkey. And it was just what I had chosen.
Yes.
And of course, like right after the film, some dude in the audience raises his hand. He's like, well, I know you seem to have a problem with viewing Super 8 in the context of home movies, but your film was shot in your house, starred your wife, and starred your pet stuffed animal. I mean, it seems like a home movie, doesn't it? And there was really nothing I could say at that point. I'm like, well, you are, you are right. And so it was, you know, it was just this horrible moment. And about that time, I started demanding drinks. I'm like, could someone get me a vodka tonic? And everybody tittered. Like, oh, that's so funny. I'm like, no, really, could you get me a drink? And then they kind of had to go break into the bar and start getting drinks. But it was just this moment where you think it's going to be great. These people fly out, you know, it's going to be this good time. You're doing something you know, and then somehow it all goes horribly wrong. And then And then the great thing is there's this other guy on the panel, this guy by the name of John Porter, who's made like 200 films. And he was really ornery, which I was really grateful for, because at some point it deflected all the anger away from me. And he, when you submit to festivals, back then you submitted on VHS, and if your film got in, you would send a print. And he started giving the festival a hard time about, I don't understand, you previewed all this stuff on VHS, this is a Super 8 festival, you should be looking at the original prints. And the people in the festival were like, you know, that's just not how it's done. And then there's this other guy on the panel, Ken Paul Rosenthal, who had this 7 Super 8 projector piece that he then got printed to 16, all 7 screens on the 16, which he showed at the festival. And then this John Porter guy starts giving Ken a hard time, like, I don't understand, you're showing 16 millimeter film. And Ken's like, well, you know, when I do it at home, I have 7 Super 8 projectors. Well, you should have done that here. And Ken's like, well, you know, I couldn't bring 7 projectors on the plane. Well, you should have asked me. And Ken's like, I just met you an hour ago. I mean, it was just, and you know, Ken was dying out there, and I'm like, well, yeah, you can die, because I'd normally come to your defense right here, but I was just sitting there kind of drinking at that point. And then after the panel, everyone comes up to me like, that was the best panel I've ever seen. That was really great. Oh, you were so awesome. I'm like, could you not have defended me at some point? You know, I'm glad I could die on the vine for your entertainment, you know.
Yeah.
But it was just one of those kind of days.
Yeah, I got flown to Australia one time, and
you got flown to Australia?
Yeah, yeah. It was a couple years ago, and they brought me over there. I was supposed to. It was this fashion company that wanted to screen print lines for my palms under their $300 jeans, and I was like all for it, you know.
Yeah,
and,
on the ass.
I just like usually down the legs, all over, and they had a whole line that were like shirts and everything. It was like, it's really wild, awesome stuff. Yeah, and I really liked the samples they sent me, and I still have 3 pairs of their pants, and like 2 pairs of them are the best fitting jeans I've ever worn.
What does it say on the ass of those jeans? Yeah,
it wouldn't I didn't actually have anything on the butt. It was more like right down you know, the legs and everything. But I get there in about an hour to get there. I had about 2 years sober or something, and it was actually, they actually had gotten King of the Roadkills. It was right before this.
Down the leg, it said, blanket of lies.
No. They had a shirt.
I'm reading from Black Spots.
Yeah, it was from Roadkills, actually.
Asphalt Matador.
Yeah. No, they had like a shirt that said Night of Horror at Quickie
Mart. As I sang karaoke in Japantown, you were thrashing about on the highway.
Yeah, one of my dead friend poems to make them really ridicule me. That's great.
Right now, I'm covering a Bucky Sinister poem.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things where, like, they you know, they read Roadkills, like, this is the Whiskey Robots is written, like, it was put together after I got sober. So, you know, I land there, and about 10 o'clock, they're like, hey, you know, let's go get some drinks. And I'm like, I don't drink anymore. And they're like, do you drink beer or wine? I'm like, no. And it was, like, explaining to, like, these Aussies that I was, like, you know, like sober. It was like explaining to like what a vegan is to someone in the Midwest, right? And like, it just wasn't gonna, they just weren't gonna get it. I was like, no. And they're like, well, like, you know, do you smoke pot?
Moments.
And they're like, no. And then like, do you do coke? And I was like, no, I don't get high at all. And
wait, it was one of my favorite moments of hanging out with a vegetarian, with a friend of a vegetarian, and a friend who's like trying to understand that. She's like, so do you eat meat? No. Do you eat fish? No. Do you eat hot dogs? No. Like, she ran out of things. Like, do you eat hot dogs?
But it was really bad. I mean, it was that moment I knew that, like, this whole week was going to go really wrong. And they were putting me up in the W Hotel. Like, they had, like, really, like, they were treating me really nice.
That's
but
so wrong.
Yeah. You know, and then, like, they were like, oh, my God.
Just give me a sleeping bag and point me to an overpass.
Yeah. And then they were like, and everything was kind of going okay until like the fashion magazine editor, like, who was staying in the hotel.
So wait, like those
next
sweatsuits that say like pink on the butt and juicy. That's you.
You came up with that.
No. These are like jeans that like cost like $300, and they're made to look really old.
I think those sweatsuits cost $300.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, they didn't make sweatsuits, but you know, $70 shirts, $300 jeans.
So what does that have to do with anything?
Well, it was really kind of embarrassing. Like, they were just like, thought I was going to come out there and party with them for a week, and I wasn't going to do anything. And they kind of like, you know, like, there was a fashion editor from from L.A. down there, who was just, you know, doing blow, and it was like pretty much a bunch of rich kids who had like started a fashion company so they could meet models and do blow with them. That was like the whole point of the company. And
why not?
And like I was still, but they still like decided to like, you know, I was supposed to like, you know, they were going to, the whole like theme of the fashion show for Fashion Week was King of the Roadkills. That was their theme. It was named after my book, and it was done. It was a whole thing, and I had like lost so much favor with them, but and they still put me up to read on at the show at the end of the week. But nobody, none of the people from the actual fashion company were in the room while I was reading. They all like stayed in another room and
doing drugs. They were just embarrassed to do drugs in front of you.
Yeah. It was just really like that was like it wasn't an exact moment, but it was just like an experience where it was like I they brought out their party kit and it was not happening, and they end up like pulling the whole deal. They end up pulling the whole line.
Just because you wouldn't drink with them?
That's right.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really like, you know, at first I was like, this is it. This is my big break. I'm just changing my life. I'm going to go, you know, because they're like, you know, if this work, when this, you know, if the line sells well, we're going to do like, you're going to have like a pair of jeans and a shirt for you every year from now on. And like, you know, we're going to fly out here like once a week, like, you know, once a year, every 4 weeks. And you know, like, and we're like, we want to like, and when we open up our U.S. office, like, you know, we're going to like, you know, have you.
You're going to have a job, CEO.
I was going to have a job. I was like, wow, this is going to be great. You know. Oh yeah. It was like, wow, that was exactly.
Are you
like,
serious?
Yeah.
Oh wait, we're digressing to people not on mic. That's bad form. All right, let's move on to Mr. Kepler.
Yeah.
You know, you guys have been telling all these like rather contemporary stories, so.
So you're gonna take us to the future?
I'm gonna take
a future embarrassing moment. Yes. In the year 2010.
No, actually, right now, no. So I'm going to go back to about 1975.
All right.
Wow. Wow, you know, 1973 is contemporary. That's amazing. You know, but
smoke on the water.
Okay, 75. I'm back.
Okay.
Back in the New York groove.
That's probably 75.
I was in junior high school at the time. I think I was maybe about, how old is junior high school? 15, something like that?
No.
They outlawed junior high by the time I got to junior high.
No, well, I was 14. I was
14, yeah. 14. Junior high school is 13, 12, 13.
This is 14. Greeley, Colorado, which is kind of like a out in the sticks north of Denver, you know, kind of the plains.
That's
the
not
plains.
Even Boulder.
No. Actually, Boulder, I did not grow up in Boulder.
So you go to an all-age King Missile show.
And there was this guy.
Anyway, I was...
That's a callback.
When I was 11, I had been... I had played Oliver I was like a musical theater kind of thespian guy. As a matter of fact, I was the president of the Colorado State Thespian Society when I was in high school.
Wow.
So I was kind of like on a early track.
Who are the great thespians to come out of Colorado?
I can't think of a single one.
Well, you obviously did a good job.
So where was this on the social strata? Did like the D&D kids make fun of you? Like what? Like, you know, were you worse off than the kids in band?
That was kind of like we were down below band. We were below.
Were you below was, chess club?
No, I was a drama club kid. I know.
We were above the 4-H'ers. That was about
the people that, having that sex was, with sheeps and stuff.
Yeah, that was but that was, you know, below the. I mean, we were just one tier up from the very, very bottom. And it was maybe about 12 of us.
It was the 4-H people and then the kids with asthma.
The headgear kid. It's like making fun of you.
Right.
Like, I can't lower myself.
Anyway, so I had been in Oliver, a university production. When I was
were you
11.
Oliver?
I was Oliver.
Okay.
Wow.
Could you say the famous line, please?
Food glorious. Oh, please, sir, I want some more?
Yeah.
Okay. I just did. There you go. Are you happy?
I am.
Wow, you really sold it. I was there.
Okay, so anyway.
All right, good, come on.
Yeah,
please.
I was like this 11-year-old ingenue, and I was like kind of at the, pretty much I think it's all been kind of downhill since then. That really, I was like, you know, I was like a shining beacon, like a shooting star. Then when I was 14, I decided to try my hand at like the local semi-professional dinner theater.
Wow.
Well, I like the notion that there's semi-professional dinner theater.
I did it. They had another. They decided to put on Oliver, and I thought, well, hey, you know, there I am, you know. But this time I was a little too old to actually be.
It's kind of weird doing Oliver at dinner theater.
Right, exactly.
Why? Why? It was perfect.
Well, you know, the whole food thing.
Because everyone's eating. Oh,
food,
glorious
food. Right. The starving orphans. And all
yeah,
that.
And while you're eating like a, you know, a T-bone or something.
Right,
yeah.
You know, this is one of the things where the actors actually double as the waiters, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you call Willie Loman over in the middle of a speech, like, yeah, I know you're upset about this woman in Boston or whatever, but, you know, could you send the steak back? You're not going to make things right with Biff and Happy, just, you know.
So in this one, I was not able to be Oliver. Actually, my younger brother played Oliver in this production, and I was demoted.
Just out of curiosity.
That would be my brother Eric.
Okay. Isn't this how Baby Jane starts?
Okay, we digress. So my brother was Oliver, and I got demoted to Fagin's Gang. I don't know if you guys know the musical.
Oh, but yeah, I've been in it.
I was a pickpocket.
I was in it in high school.
So there's like Fagin's Gang, and I was one of these kind of pickpocket dudes, and then there's the Artful Dodger, who's like, you know, Fagin's main like henchman. Anyway, there was one performance in particular where I started noticing that the Artful Dodger was the guy who was playing the Artful Dodger. I forget his name, but he was starting to turn noticeably green about like halfway through, like maybe the brisket or something. I don't know, but we're backstage in the intermission, and there was a sudden flurry of panic because the Artful Dodger was passed out out immediately.
He's gone to slaw.
He passed out in his gruel, and he was like he was on the sofa, and he was done basically. Wow. And there was this big panic, and they had to find
what
somebody.
What was wrong with him?
He had food poisoning.
Oh, great.
And when you're doing dinner theater, you really don't want to know that your audience might all start vomiting at some point.
So there was a mad scramble, and of course they settled on me because I was, you know, had all this quote unquote experience. So I was the oldest. I was kind of like one of these kind of a little too old really even to be in this production.
How old were you? 14?
I was 14, really. And then most of the kids were like 12, 11, 12, 13.
I like the notion of going to dinner theater, a classy night out, and then being entertained by 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that something try to avoid?
Well, the gang.
Oh, wait, the Oliver, right? Because Oliver is a young kid.
No, the roles were mostly college co-eds.
Oh, okay.
Which was actually my main motivation to be in this thing in the first place, because I was...
College goyles.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
I spent most of my time in their lap.
Yeah, spit some 14-year-old game at him. Yeah. I've got Atari and television at home.
So they settle on me. I had to be... There was this mad scramble. They managed to get the guy's costume off and put it on me. And,
puke on it.
And I was like, I don't know the lines, you know, I don't know anything. Like, am I supposed to do this? I'll be all right. I'll be in the director with
the Jerry, fill up their wine glasses again. Complimentary, we're going to need it.
The director says, okay, I'm going to be, it's a theater and around, but there was this kind of like, this corridor on the main level, on the ground level that goes into the stage. And he says, I'll be there with the script, you know, and I'll just like
feeding
me the lines, you know? And help, you know, like, and how do I know where to go? I didn't know the blocking or anything.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And he said, I'll point, you know.
This isn't going to end good.
So anyway, I get out there and you know, they roll the cart away, the roast beef, you know. Fortunately, I think the character had maybe about 7 lines total in the second act. And most of the main Artful Dodger action happens in the first act of that musical. But there was enough that that I was in mortal terror, basically. And there was a lot of blocking, you know. Mm-hmm. So basically,
there's a lot of artful dodging there was, to be done.
And it's been so long, I don't remember the details of like what exactly happened. All I remember is being in a blind terror and kind of like trotting out, you know, onto the set. And the guy was back there, and he goes, go like the director was pointing, and so like I would just go over here, you know, and stand over there, and like I would try to like do like they had like, you know, he had dance moves and all
right,
that. And
I
was trying to like
do the hustle.
Do these dance moves, and I was like muddling them badly, you know. I was a horrible dancer actually, but and I basically blanked out and wasn't even able to say my lines. And like, you know, it was one of those things where the person next to me was going, elbowing me in the side, you know, like, come on, it's your line. I just froze. I lost my ability to say anything. And so they just, basically the entire second half of the show was kind of a muff, as a result of that whole, fiasco.
And I guess you weren't hired back.
No.
Okay.
Did any of the co-eds take you into their arms that night as a result of your...
No. I didn't get any fringe like that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be kind of impossible to have as much gauze as a 14-year-old to pull this off, but it would have been great if you could have, like, improvised your own show. It's like, well, like you said, they don't know the lines anyway. I'm going to make them all about me and just start talking all the time and just interrupting everyone.
Well, that's like, your style.
Yeah. Start kissing the co-eds, you know, like... You know, I just right in the middle of play, like just turn around to the girl you like
Grease?
The most, and
yeah,
dude,
go, Dickens.
I've always loved you. I've always loved you. Come here, baby.
Well, Bucky, I wish I'd had. Looking back, that's really what I should have done.
The wherewithal. Well, fantastic. 4, 5 fantabulous stories.
Yeah,
of shame, humiliation,
doubled
embarrassment.
Up there a little bit.
Yeah. Hey, you know, he got an extra one too.
You saw like a couple minor ones in there too, right?
Oh, I know the Australian one.
Yeah, Australian story. Australian stories.
Yeah,
There's so many. There's so many. Right? You know, like drunk and sober. It's just like one of those things that, like, yeah, there's a lot. I'm like, oh, I was really drunk and I did this, and then there's just a lot. I'm like, nah, I'm just kind of dumb sometimes and take chances I shouldn't, and there it goes, comes back and bites me in the ass.
Well, yeah, but that's
either you're too drunk or you're too sober.
Yeah.
There's exactly. No happy ground.
Nah, there's not.
And on that fine note, we will call it a day. All right, this is Danny Plotnick, and you've been listening to the Nest of Vipers podcast. If you enjoy the show and want to dig deeper, check out our YouTube page at youtube.com/Nest of Vipers podcast, where you can see clips that relate to the cultural references mentioned in the show. Also, if you'd like to leave us a comment, please visit our MySpace page at myspace.com/Nest of Vipers podcast. And as always, Nest of Vipers is distributed by KQED Interactive.